It's quiet. The main movement is this walking pace cortege with several hundred people in it. His colleagues, his listeners, people paying their last respects on Dennis's final journey through Nottingham after 28 years as its most loved, its most respected, its finest broadcaster.
On the day of his funeral, I spoke to my aunt and uncle, his brother, who had come up from London, and I said, oh, we're starting off at York House and we're going through the city and whatever. I said, they think some people will be there to see. And they said, oh, I don't know why. Are you sure? I said, yeah. And all the way as we drove up and we came up, I said, Huntingdon Street, right on the back, if there's nobody here, this is really going to be embarrassing. Because we thought my dad was great, but did the people of Nottingham?
And then the funeral itself took place and stopped Nottingham. I've never seen anything like it. The church itself was absolutely packed. People outside, people that Dennis had made friends of over the years, who'd started off just appearing as contributors to his programme and had become people who had to be there.
I mean, I walked with the mourners, chief mourner being Ken Dodd, through the streets to the cathedral on Derby Road. I mean, there were 2,000 people outside the cathedral because the service was relayed outside on loudspeakers.
There was Sir Paul Smith. Parrotface Davis is one of his heroes. He was there. Jeff Owens remembers him going to the local pub at Bingham where the burial was. And Ken Dodd, Parrotface Davis, walked into this pub and said, the woman couldn't believe it.
This is the story of a radio presenter who captured his city and whose programmes and personality are remembered 20 years after his death. This is the story of Dennis McCarthy.
I actually tried to get a job officially with BBC Radio Nottingham before the station opened. There was an advertisement in the local paper with all the jobs that had to be filled on the local radio station, and I applied, and I got the fastest rejection note I should think the BBC ever sent out, because, of course, I had no educational qualifications and no other qualifications that would interest the BBC. So I was rejected at the very beginning, but I wasn't deflated. And I listened to the broadcasts that were made before officially Radio Nottingham was on the air. And I was big-headed enough to think, I could do as well as that.
And the chimes of Little John, Nottingham's city clock, signal the fact that Radio Nottingham is officially on the air. Good evening, everyone.
So I waited. I waited for a week after the radio station had opened. And then I thought, I was very interested in dogs, how about a Crufts dog show report for 1968? So I got in touch with the then programme organiser at Radio Nottingham with my suggestion. And he said, yes, if I'd like to come in and talk about it.
So he went along armed with a script already written and said, I've written a script about Crufts. And they said, oh, thank you very much. He says, no, I'm reading it.
Oh, no, don't think so. But, well, we'll see. And he put a stopwatch in his hand and timed me. And he said, yes, you didn't do it too badly. Come on through and see if we can get the news producer to use it tonight. So, trembling with excitement, I went in the operations room, where Keith Salmon was the producer that night, and Robert McLeish was the programme organiser. Robert went to Keith and said, I've got this bloke with quite an interesting dog report, and it's very local. It's all about show winners, local show winners at Crufts. And Keith said, oh, no. Oh, I couldn't have it. Not in tonight's programme, Robert. No, tell him to come back. So Robert said, well, it's a bit difficult. That's him there. And I was only about 3 inches away. So, ever so reluctantly, they let me do it.
He interviewed Margie, his wife, who was showing at Crufts. That was the story. Well, she wasn't his wife then. And they said, yeah, very good, whatever. And, of course, they'd lent him the old tape machine. He'd come back filling a 6-inch spool, so that half an hour interview of which they said, yes, this is a news thing, so you got a minute 45 or something. He couldn't edit or anything then. He had no idea what it was about. So they put him in a studio, showed him how to do it. He took to this. And I think they thought probably, yeah, it was all right, and he'll never come back, and he'll just go away.
So the following week, I rang up again and said, I've got an interesting story about dog exports from Nottingham going all over the world. Oh, come in, said Robert McLeish, and this time it was Tony Church, the producer, and he was as reluctant as Keith Salmon had been to put me on the air, but he did do, and again I was asked to come back. Well, I came back every week.
My dad being my dad, got the bit between his teeth and went back to them, and they said, well, we've done a dog one now, do you know anything else? Which he didn't. And the headliner at the Theatre Royal at the time was Ken Dodd. Ken didn't do interviews. So my dad being my dad said to the then programme organiser, I'll get an interview with Ken Dodd. And he's, you know, thought, well, this will get rid of Mr. McCarthy once and for all. That ain't going to happen.
So still runs the river on its journey to the sea.
So my dad brings Ken, who was a very good friend because of the theatrical side, and I think got something like a 20-30 minute interview out of him, which they played snippets of continually for the week. And my dad would earn sixpence or six shillings or whatever it was per every time one was broadcast. It was worth a fortune. At the time, he was a jobbing painter and decorator. He had been a washing machine salesman till he crashed the van, which didn't go down well with a load of washing machines in the back and a dog. And he therefore went on from there because they realised, oh, this guy might have some connections and he's serious. And he went on and they gave him his own show.
And that's it from Dave Cash for today, because it's 4 o'clock and on BBC Radio Nottingham, that means on a Monday it's time to take the lead.
Hello there, Dennis McCarthy here with the first of our new series of dog programmes in which we take the lead.
I think a point here, actually, that I'd like to bring up now, and I'd like to ask Father this, I think, to end, and this is a problem that I know is affecting Nottingham at the present time, and that is the number of old people with perhaps dogs that are getting on in years, though perhaps not ill or anything like that, who are moving out of areas that are being cleared into flats where they just don't allow dogs. Now, what happens in a case like this?
Take the Lead was introduced by Dennis McCarthy.
Although dogs were the trick Dennis used to get through the door at York House, radio and performance were very much in the blood. Dennis's son Digger, Owen McCarthy.
Our family was very much into old-time musical. The only member I knew of them was my Aunt Betty, or my dad's Aunt Betty, who was one of the Page sisters, who were a very big act. And Uncle George, my dad's Uncle George, was Flanagan and Allen's manager. So we can trace the family back in the theatrical line, because theatrical history was a very well documented history. And we go back to the Elizabethan actor, Edmund Kean, who was the first Shakespearean actor to be knighted. He is an ancestor. And we can also go back to the chap who owned the Drury Lane Theatre, who of course wrote God Save the King, as it was in those days. And because of that, because of the family history, and people like the Page sisters, who were massive. Dan Leno, the great comedian, was a member of the family. And they were like theatre royalty. And because of that, my dad had a lot of contacts prior to his radio. My dad was in films. He when he was evacuated, he was evacuated twice from London when he was a kid, when he would be 6-7 years old. And the first time he was evacuated to family in Denham. And Denham Village is right next to the studio. And so he was an extra, him and his brothers, in when he wanted kids in the background. He was one of those scruffy urchins in the background.
He actually found a film of him as a child, you know. One of these public information films, war films. He was so proud of it. There was a film crew around, and he remembered there was apparently a plane going to fly over, and these boys had to wave. So he just remembers being filmed waving. And he got all this old archive film, and there he saw himself as a boy waving to a plane going over. Isn't that a lovely story?
Clairvoyant, calling operations room.
No sign of any other aircraft about. Still no sign of B for Bertie. Over.
That's how he got in. If it hadn't have been for the family connections, well before radio, going back generations, he wouldn't have interviewed Ken Dodd. He'd have had 1 minute 45 seconds of a Crufts insert into a news, and he'd have been forgotten.
This is BBC Radio Nottingham, and for our listeners on Radio Fusion, there's David Simons. Whereas for our listeners on VHF, it's The Dales.
Back then, BBC Radio Nottingham was finding its feet. It was the fourth in the BBC's reluctant new network, and part of what had been a two-year experiment. Fellow presenter John Holmes.
Nottingham City Council were funding half of it, BBC was funding half, and therefore it was set up on a sort of ad hoc basis with no proper BBC staff posts, or very few. So the newsroom wasn't in our newsroom. It used to arrive by bike with John Hobson, who was a freelance. And there were no real reporters, so freelances moved in the territory. And the three freelances who came in were Don Truscott, Al Heath and Dennis McCarthy. They were there when I first arrived. Well, the three freelancers were strange, really, because they had totally different personalities. I mean, totally different. But they were all looking over their shoulder at the other one, because freelancers do that all their life. You know, they're worried about competition. Therefore, there was a lot of jealousy, and I wouldn't say people fell out. They didn't fall out, but you could see they were chasing stories.
That often unspoken rivalry was clear in later times too. Trevor Dan.
At the time that Dennis was being quite competitive with me, I had made a documentary series for Radio Nottingham with Tony Church called The Chronicles of Nottingham. And I was told to present myself in his studio where he would interview me as a trail for part one of The Chronicles of Nottingham, which would be starting on Sunday morning. So I turned up somewhat diffidently with my sheaf of notes, and I sat down next to him. There was only one microphone at the round table where he used to sit. The SA sat on the other side of the room behind the desk and actually drove the programme, got the callers up and put the records on. So I sat next to Dennis, and he said, well, starting this weekend, there's a brand new programme. It's called The Chronicles of Nottingham, and here to tell us all about it is Trevor Dan. And there was pause, and I was expecting a question, but no question came. So I suppose I just kind of launched into a thank you, Dennis, and what we're trying to do in this show. And no sooner had I started than he got up and left. So there I am, stranded with a microphone and somebody else on the other side of the room. I don't know how long he's gone for. I don't know how long my slot is. I have to just keep talking. And I don't know whether he did this as a prank or whether he was genuinely trying to prove that I wasn't as good as he was at this kind of thing.
Dennis was given a regular Sunday morning programme, which became the stuff of legend. And back then, like Morecambe and Wise on the TV, everybody, in Nottingham at least, listened to Dennis. Kevin Brewer helped out.
We started, opening of the Sunday show was Swap Shop. We'd then move into our Look At It bonus, at which point we'd make a call out for Wanted Column of the Air, which would then go on after we'd done the competition, a few records chat. Then we'd do Giveaway, and at the very end of the show, we brought on Family Jackpot, which was actually really was a very large box with the words Family Jackpot all over the place.
Yeah, the features, of course, were things like Swap Shop and Bargain Basement and all things like that, and the competitions, with the typewriter song bashing away, you know, counting down to when you had to answer the questions, and if you got the first bit right, you won a single, which most people say, can you send it to the hospital, Dennis? And then I think the next thing was an LP, and so it built up to a £5 shopping spree at the Victoria Centre, or dancing lessons with Roy and Mary Knight.
In charge of the station's programming in the mid-70s was Ron Coles.
And, of course, he got most of his family involved in it, too, because his son, Digger, became his, quote, producer. And then his daughter, Tara, the youngest DJ in the world, was brought onto the programme to present some of the music.
I never remember not being on the radio. I have no memory. Every Sunday, it was going to the Sunday show, to York House, as it used to be, and in the varying studios, and that's what we did on a Sunday, you know. I assume that's what everybody did. Because that's what I did, I just assumed that's what everybody else did. And it kind of came to me as a shock as I was sort of went to school and things, that people didn't do that on a Sunday morning.
Dennis's Sunday show was a miracle because it was full of stuff that really, in retrospect, wasn't very good. But he made it good. He managed to inject some life into it by slightly sardonically underselling it. They were not very valuable prices, but a bit like Terry Wogan's blankety blank checkbook and pen, he invested in them an enormous amount of time and effort such that you almost thought, blimey, I've got to enter. I want to have my ears painlessly pierced by Boys as the Jewellers.
I used to take issue with Dennis over the records because records was my big thing. And I started running the library. When I arrived, there was about 12 LPs there. And I set the library up. And I used to say, Dennis, you can't give these records away. They're garbage. I mean, they're not even worth us frisbees. Ah, don't worry. So he used to give absolute rubbish away. And my programme was very selective, so they had something decent, but not with Dennis. Don't give him anything.
I remember coming up to find a house, and I listened to the station while I was driving around looking to see where I wanted to live, and Dennis was on. And I remember that afternoon, he had on the other end of the telephone a lady who hadn't got her teeth in. And he said, what are you saying? So she's... Repeat, said, oh, I'm ever so sorry, Dennis, I haven't got my teeth in. I'll go and put them in. She said, for goodness sake, go and get them in. So she went and put her teeth in. And then she came back and, of course, predictably, he said, no, I can't understand a word you're saying now. Take them out again.
Now we have a call from Jill Lempard of Alford.
I've been holding for a long time now. It's about my poll tax. I'm trying to get it sorted out.
I'm afraid you got the wrong number.
Well, I've been holding on for about 10 minutes and there's just been this music playing in my ear hole.
Yes. Well, actually, it's a sort of musical competition that we're doing this afternoon. We're nothing to do with the poll tax here, I'm afraid.
Oh, where is that then, love? Because I thought I'd dial the Notts County Council.
It's the BBC.
I'm on the television?
No, the radio.
The radio?
Yes.
What am I doing on there, then?
Well, you rang us, you see, and you came up on our number, and
And you're doing some sort of a competition?
Yes, some sort. Yes, that's right.
Well, I don't think I want you, do I, love?
No, I don't think you do. I'm sorry, I can't help you.
I'm ever so sorry, love.
No, that's all right. I'm sorry that...
I'm getting in a right rumpus about my poll tax. I've paid it, and I keep getting these reminders.
Oh, I should get in touch with them, then.
I'm trying. I thought I was on hold to the community charge department.
No, can you try again? I think it's important that you try again, perhaps.
I'll try again.
Okay, love.
Okay, I'm ever so sorry.
No, that's all right. That's okay. No, it was nice talking to you.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
He didn't hurry anyone up. There was none of that, briefly if you can, or sorry to wind this up, but we've got to hit the pips, or we've got to get to travel, or news, or any of those things. He let people talk. He gave them space.
And there were two elderly ladies talking. So you got one elderly lady talking, and the other one elderly lady talking. And what he'd do was, he'd just leave it. And this is absolutely true. He got these two women talking. He put his microphone down, he walked through a very large crowd, went to the baker's, bought himself a sausage roll and then came back. And all you could hear was, are you listening, Dennis? And then they carry on. And he picked up, yeah. He had that confidence.
Dennis's final producer was Sophie Shardlow.
He allowed for silence in a way that no one else does. He'd say, OK, if somebody rang up and the front doorbell went, he'd say, go and answer it, who's at the door? And we all hung on as listeners, waiting to see who was at the door.
It was the way that Dennis would talk to the other contributors. So if somebody just came on the air to sell something, it would be he would get something out of everybody.
One of the ideas is that you set up a competition not to see if they're going to get the right answer, but to talk to them. And okay, some of his stuff was cliché. What are you having for Sunday lunch and all that? But people loved it because they were meeting personalities from their own community. It wasn't just somebody answering quiz questions. It wasn't just somebody trying to swap a washing machine for a bicycle. He brought them out and he got their story as well. You know, so what are you doing today? What did you do last week? And he drew them out and people liked those human stories.
What sort of work do you do if you don't make many saddles now?
Well, I do it with a lot of shoe repairing.
Dennis's Sunday success was soon recognised. Early 70s manager, Tom Beasley.
That was really when the management team, Ron and me and other people, saw more to Dennis than just the Sunday show with the youngest DJ in the world and all that sort of stuff.
4 o'clock this afternoon, we have our usual Tuesday afternoon feature, Where Are You Now? And that's where we try to reunite long-lost friends, relatives and neighbours. If you've lost touch with someone and they're still in the Nottingham area, ring us throughout the afternoon on Nottingham 44444 and we'll ring you back just after 4 o'clock when we have Where Are You Now?
By the mid-70s, after some weekday exposure on programmes like Roundabout Midday, Dennis was given a regular afternoon show, and Afternoon Special gave him a chance to explore more of those characters and stories. Dennis's son, digger Owen McCarthy.
We went to interview Elsie Hill, and Elsie Hill lived in Nottingham with her sister, and they were the sisters that took the pictures of the fairies at the bottom of the garden.
Well, you've kept quiet for something like 50 years. Why all this time?
Well, because I was very tired of the whole thing.
But anyway, while we were there, they said, why, yeah, you ought to go and interview this chap who lives on the next street. And Mr. Cotton. And my dad said, yeah, OK, why? So we went back to the car. He's got his ewer. We've got another 6-inch spool. He said, I'm Dennis McCarthy. I'm from the BBC. And I'd like to come and interview you. Not knowing what we were interviewing him about. And he said, oh, well, I don't like to talk about it. I went, oh, right. My dad was there with his usual charm. Thankfully, with the Irish blood in him, he managed to persuade the talk the chap round to interview him. He was the radio operator that took the SOS call from the Titanic. Now, where are you ever going to meet those sort of people?
They weren't always called public laundries. They were public washhouses until 1960, and then came the posher image of a laundry. The Portland washhouse first opened its doors in 1931, and as Nottingham's baths manager, George Fern, remembers, it was always popular.
That time there were 36 washing stalls, 36 drying racks or drying...
The other thing that sometimes is forgotten when people talk about Dennis is that he was a really good interviewer. The interview I would single out, one that I remember very vividly, was his interview with Tony Benn. Now, Tony Benn was a very controversial character in the 70s and 80s, and I guess this would be late 70s when he did this particular interview. But Dennis got him talking about being in the RAF, about being a patriot, about not being, you know, Godzilla. He managed to tell us, or help Tony Benn to tell us, that lurking behind all that stuff that we read in the papers was a real beating heart of a genuine, charitable, and actually rather likeable man.
I remember Neil Kinnock said, I like going on with Dennis because he asked the questions that the man on the street would want to ask, but wouldn't know how to ask.
It's great going about and a bus driver will push aside his window and shout, hey, Dennis, and you shout, hey, back. And he's never seen you before, but he feels that he knows you.
Remember, he was a door-to-door salesman. He sold washing machines. He knew how to get his foot in the door. I mean, he told me once that he'd knocked up a woman at 2 o'clock in the morning and said to her, hello, I've come to sell you a washing machine. And she said, it's 2 o'clock in the morning. He said, well, on the postcard, it says I can call at any time. So I have. I happen to be passing.
Hello and welcome to Wednesday's edition of Afternoon Special. Well, no one's coming in this afternoon, so it's just thee and me. And if you'd like to have a natter on the programme, the number to ring is Nottingham 44444.
One of Dennis's real gifts was his instinct for where the real story lay, and indeed the real entertainment value too, even when things didn't go quite according to plan.
We used to do a link-up with RTE Ireland, which is the Irish equivalent of the BBC. We did it two or three times, and they were fine, but there was one particular occasion. Tell you, Dennis, OK, Kathleen's available, and as usual, Dennis starts to wind up. Well, it's time to join RTE and Kathleen Watkins. Are you there?
This is BBC Radio.
Maybe having a little late supper?
Pardon? Who's that?
Yes, hello. Anybody there?
Yes, we're here. Hello. Catherine?
Can't hear a thing.
You can't hear... We can hear you. Hello, Catherine. Hello, Dublin. This is BBC Radio Nottingham.
Is he still talking to me? He's
still talking to you.
Yes. Hello.
Hello.
Yes, I can faintly hear him saying
just,
hello.
Just faintly.
Impossible.
Yes.
It's got speak to, some more.
It's got to be better than that, hasn't it?
Oh, you're so far away, we couldn't be.
No, we couldn't.
Yes, Roisin. RTE is slightly faulty. We're faulty and we're making adjustments and things and all will be well, I'm told to say.
I'm not even saying anything.
Hmm?
I said I'm not saying anything.
You're not saying anything.
No, how can I be faint when I'm not saying anything?
Oh, you're not saying anything.
Yes, I'll Kathy. Just sack an engineer. Just hang on a minute.
Okay.
I've sacked him. Kathleen!
Yes.
Can you hear me clearly?
Kathleen Watkins. That's not as Irish as McCarthy.
No, I know it isn't. Perhaps you should come here and I should come there. Listen, can you hear me clearly?
Hello?
Hello. Kathleen?
I can't hear
I'm
him.
I'm not listening to you anymore.
Oh, isn't that?
I am.
He is listening to me.
I am listening to you.
You are listening
we
to
can
me.
Hear I you
can,
perfectly.
I
but
can't
well,
hear
during
him.
That
no.
10 or 15 minutes, Dennis instead of just going to a record and saying, oh, well, we'll get back to when we can. No, he thought, going to enjoy this, because he realised we, the audience in Nottingham, could hear everything going on in RTE. But what RTE didn't know was that they thought they were only talking to us in the studio and not broadcasting.
I tell you what, I'll play a piece of music and that ought to, it might regenerate things.
He's going to play a piece of music and see, you know, what happens.
You know, when it started, the very first week, by then we'd already done phone-ins. We did, I call it the moaning, because that's all they did.
Open line, open line, open line, open line, open line, open line.
I remember us going live with the first phone-in with no music, and that we established there was a phone-in number. When Dennis came on the air with that phone-in, he blocked off the whole of the city. You know how, if you look at somebody's code, like mine's 923 at the beginning, if someone else is 923, I know they're neighbours. Well, we shared the same beginning of our telephone number as the police. So we blocked off the whole of the police. There were no calls coming through to Nottingham. It jammed the switchboard. So we then had to invent another number, especially for Dennis's programme. That's how popular it was. And it happened almost instantly.
He was a very amusing guy. I think he was genuinely interested in people. I think that was the key to his success, really. And he was totally focused on the person he was talking to and when he was broadcasting, just to the listener that he was speaking to. I actually learned quite a lot from Dennis myself in the way that he approached broadcasting, because he didn't worry about fluffing or all the things that we can get obsessed about when we're broadcasting. He would just focus on talking to that one listener.
Radio Nottingham on 95.4 and 197.
And then in 19... when would it be? 1980? The other East Midlands stations started to take his programme in the afternoon, and their audience figures rocketed. He was immensely popular. I mean, particularly as it happens in Lincolnshire, when he was rebroadcast on Radio Lincolnshire. There's a wonderful story about Dennis in his Lincolnshire days. He had a phone call from a woman in Lincolnshire, and he said, oh, yes, how are you? What are you doing this afternoon? And she said, well, I was planning to go shopping, but I'm not going now because I'm afraid. And he said, well, what are you afraid of? She said, well, there's a group of young blokes hanging about outside the house, and I just think that they're up to mischief. And Dennis said, well, open the window, call one of them over, and I'll have a word with them. She did, and Dennis said something like, what do you think you're doing frightening an old woman? And this youth said, well, we're nothing to do, it's boring here in Lincolnshire, wherever. So he said, well, look, I tell you what, why don't all of you take this lady down to the shop, help her carry her shopping back home, and she'll no doubt be very grateful. And that's what they did. And I thought, well, I can't imagine anybody else ever thinking of doing that.
It's true, famously, that Dennis didn't get on with all his interviewees, but some he formed a close relationship with.
I interviewed Emrys Bryson recently, and Emrys said his fondest memory is when Dennis and he were there to interview Eartha Kitt. Now, I remember meeting Eartha Kitt about, must have been the same time, and she's one of these people, when she walks into a room, she's only little, but she has presence. Every now and then you meet a star who has presence. Sometimes they have nothing. You think, oh, I'm a bit disappointed there. But no, she burnt her personality into a room. And she needed some help with a dress. Dennis helped her with his dress. And I think Emrys Bryson said, after that,
she had no eyes for me. All she had was eyes for Dennis. And he said, I expect them to announce their wedding arrangements later, he said, because he just wooed people.
Starring in the West End at the moment, a welcome return to the West End. But it's very difficult to introduce her because, well, I guess Orson Welles did it best when he said about this woman, she is the most exciting woman in the world. That's what he said about Eartha Kitt.
And one of his favourite and my favourite events was when we took 11 coachloads of listeners down to the London Palladium for a live variety show. It was a magical afternoon.
Hello and welcome to Monday's edition of Afternoon Special from the London Palladium. Yes, indeed. Afternoon special live from the London Palladium. We've got some marvellous artists to entertain you, some special guests for you to meet, and the important thing is no one, but no one in our audience of 2,302 knows who's going to be here. You don't know who's going to be here, do you?
No! I remember once that he took everybody to Blackpool on trains, and the BBC, bless their hearts, said, oh no, we're not going to fund this. And he got a bank agreement to mortgage his house to take his listeners to Blackpool, and he, if he hadn't worked, he'd have lost his house. And I mean, it was £5 a ticket for people to go for travel to Blackpool and a free show with top stars. And he said no. And I remember him coming home and him and Margie discussing it, and he said no. And he went to the bank and he got a collateral letter or whatever you get from the bank that it would go on the mortgage on the house. Fortunately, he was oversubscribed with it for listeners, so he didn't have to do that.
And, of course, there was the famous royal visit when Dennis did the commentary from the radio car, and the people in the streets, lining the streets, were all going wild and shouting, and there was a terrific noise. But as our car went by, you could hear, well, some of them were shouting for Her Majesty, but quite a lot of them were shouting, Dennis!
It's an apocryphal story, I'm sure of this, but it was reported that somebody standing in the crowd on Mansfield Road said to somebody next to, who's that woman in the car in front of Dennis McCarthy?
A busy day for the royal party, who started their tour in Mansfield, where the Queen was to open the new county library and then meet the people on a walkabout through the marketplace. Radio Nottingham's commentator at the scene was Dennis McCarthy.
A few yards away now, waving to the crowd, looking very, very happy. Just 2 yards away from us, just 2 yards away from us, the Queen, the doors being opened, and the Queen comes to Mansfield.
I mean, I can remember on one occasion, it was when the Queen's Silver Jubilee in 1977, the management team, we were sitting in my office planning what we should do as a radio station to mark the occasion, and the radio was on in the background, and then all of a sudden we heard Dennis say, right, well, what we're going to do is we're going to organise a little street parties and we'll have a competition, and I'll have a word with Pork Farm Pies to see if we can get some pork pies, and we'll bring them round and there'll be a prize for the winner. We hadn't even discussed this. I mean, he decided what was going on, and that, I mean, it was outrageously successful, really, but a real problem. I mean, we had to drive around on the day of the week of the Queen's visit, to something like 48 street parties and decide which one of them was worthy of a pork pie.
And we're going to go backwards. We're going to go third, second and first. So third was Bob Royson, 49 Galway Road, Arnold. And Bob wins a portable radio, value approximately £20.
He would fall out with management. He had the guts, which I haven't, to say, well, if you don't like it, I'm off. I think he did actually leave the station at one point. He walked out because he had an issue with management. He said, right, all right then. Because he had such good audience figures, they were frightened.
He was fired three times in total, twice on the radio, once from television. I haven't got the firing letters from the radio. I have his rehiring letters. I have the firing letter from the television upstairs. He fell out with whoever, station manager, on how he thinks broadcasting should be. I would imagine the first time they rescinded it by, I think, before he'd actually left the building. But he had a proper written thing. The second time it took a week, and thankfully the listeners of Nottingham decided that they did like him and wrote in their droves to the radio station. So basically by public request they hired him back again, and he came back, and again he went on for another however many years after that, because that was quite early on. His style of wanting to do things for the listener didn't always sit right with the people above, and things that he would do were not the done things.
I started my broadcasting career as a seconded teacher, so I was always very sympathetic to the education department at the radio stations, but Dennis had no sympathy whatsoever for this programming, which he found to be totally didactic and something that was killing his audience. And he would storm into my office and say, "Take this off now, or I won't go on." And we'd have this discussion several times a month. And always I'd say, OK, Dennis, have you got your records out? Yes. Right, give them to me. You go home. I'll do the show. And he'd laugh. And, of course, he'd go on and do the programme.
I think he was tolerated. I think that's probably the right word for it. Because he didn't conform to, certainly not to the BBC's idea about what they should be about. He didn't, in the sense of relating to senior management, he was not deferential in any respect, which was out of the BBC's character. He didn't aim to be difficult.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to this concert with the Simon May Orchestra. I think you and I are in for some surprises tonight, but if I can just explain who I am and why I'm here. My name is Dennis McCarthy, and I work for BBC Radio Nottingham. And I'm here because tonight's concert is being recorded, and it's going to be broadcast sometime early in the new year.
He would probably spend the morning creosoting the fence or something, and then he'd come in to do his show in the afternoon, arriving about maybe 20 minutes before the programme was due to go out, still smelling of creosote and with his clothes still covered in it. And I remember one day he kept hens as well as dogs, and, you know, he bred Afghan hounds, but he also kept hens. And one particular morning, I remember, he'd popped an egg into his pocket as he'd been doing his rounds at home. And as he was talking to me, he thrust his hand into his pocket to make a point, broke the egg and brought the hand out, dripping yolk.
But he had this way of adopting a cause, and there was a Sally Ann Carter one you must know about. Sally Ann Carter's still around, but she had this condition which was very rare, and he said, you know, we've got to save her life. And quite possibly he did, actually. At the same time, we'd been over to Munich to see Forest European Cup. Dennis and I covered that, and with the sports team. And he was very close with Peter Taylor. So he said to Peter, I've got this fundraising I want to do in the Old Market Square. I want to raise, I don't know, it was a huge amount, but £18,000, a huge amount of money. I want to raise it in the day.
And obviously before the days of technology and sort of being able to donate very quickly, so I think Dad had sort of mobilised an army of people to drop letters, to drop envelopes, and you could put money in the envelopes, and the idea was you'd come and you could give it to somebody in the Old Market Square and raised a phenomenal amount of money.
Dennis was really a man of the people. He was a very dear person, a great friend of ours, as was the family, and he really did change lives. And in our case, or in the case of children like Sally, he brought hope where there was no hope. And you know, you must remember that when I contacted Dennis, you know, way back in 1979, and Sally was diagnosed with tuberous sclerosis, there literally was no medical research and children were dying.
Dennis was seen on TV too, hurrying down Derby Road to the BBC's regional TV operation.
There was a small television studio and a radio studio there, and we fed into Midlands Today, which was Birmingham-based programme. And, Dennis started doing that. And indeed, when East Midlands opt-out, as it was when it started with the lunchtime news, Dennis presented it because we thought that, you know, he would carry with him his audience, which he did.
And the television, of course, then went on, and then he went national. He did used to do the odd national piece. But, yeah, I mean, he did Crufts, and that got him big recognition.
The news is at 6:30. Now we join Dennis McCarthy and Les Crawley as they look at A World of Dogs. Welcome to A World of Dogs from Newstead Abbey in Nottinghamshire.
He worked with Martin Lacey. Do you remember Sherwood Zoo? He worked with Martin Lacey. Martin Lacey was a bit like Dennis, a good salesman. And to push Sherwood Zoo, he would look what was happening and then come up with an angle, which Dennis then could sell to the radio and then sell onto Midlands Television. There was no East Midlands then. So I remember there was the giraffe with a sore throat. I mean, just because, or was a stiff neck, I can't remember what. He had, when there was a sugar shortage, he got in touch with Martin and said, is there any stories we can do about the sugar shortage? Or Martin got in touch with him. And Martin said, well, my Gibraltar apes, they have to have sugar and they're going to die. So we ran this story. I mean, they're going to die. They're going to run this story. And the reception became full of sugar. All these pensioners, bless them, bringing their... This sugar, which was in shortage, was all over the studios. It was mad. He used to say to Martin, this is no good unless they make a noise.
But had to wait until he'd moulted and then his feathers grew again.
He's not being very vocal at the moment, but he is normally, isn't he?
Yes, we have a long conversation.
I think he started at the right time. Again, I mean, Radio Nottingham was a couple of months old. Therefore, there were no parameters. And because of that, that's, I think, why he shone. If he'd have been stymied with earlier BBC, so some of the national stuff that was there around then, or later, where ratings and you were in perhaps more competition with the commercial radio stations for audience. If it had been in either of those eras, I don't think it had worked.
January the 10th, 1996.
If I remember correctly, it was a Friday evening. I think he'd done his show. I'm not sure whether he finished it, but he certainly went home. People knew he wasn't well. And he did get home, but died quite suddenly, shortly afterwards. What I do remember, because of course, don't forget, I was no longer at the radio station by this time. This was some years afterwards. But I did tune in, and I remember the tributes that just poured in, not for half an hour, not for an hour, but for about 2 days.
Well, one of his greatest interviews was on the day he died, the man, the tiling man, who destroyed more tiles than he put on the wall. And it was on the day he died, and he was very, very ill, finishing that broadcast, obviously. And that was one of his greatest ones. And this was a guy, he was trying to tile his bathroom, and that was it. But it was a stunning interview.
I was doing a programme about ballroom dancing, funny enough, for Radio 2. I just got a phone call that day and I was absolutely shocked. I've got an entry in my diary the next day saying, I can't believe Dennis has died. This is a terrible shock. He was only 62, for goodness sake. He made me cross because he wouldn't listen to the doctor. He did work himself into the ground. And sometimes I think, well, perhaps if I'd been around, I'd have stood in for him more. But he did trust me. But I used to say to him, you've got to take the needle on this diabetes because they've told you you have to. I'm not doing that.
It was never right that he died so young. He died at the height, you know, when he was still at the height, which for him, not for the ones of his left behind, but for him, what a way to go. Going home, saying, don't feel well, and being dead a few seconds later. Having just done his show and still, that would have been in his mind, and having done this great interview with the tiling man, and yeah.
Dennis was very, very special.
When he died, I was asked to write an obituary for the staff newspaper in London. And I found that terribly difficult. I mean, I wanted to use the word unique all the time. It shouldn't be used, it's, you know. But he was.
As I've always said, my dad did it for the listeners and for the enjoyment of doing it. He never did it certainly didn't do it for the money. He didn't do it to promote himself particularly or to further his career. He liked holding a microphone, talking to people one to one.
he was able to communicate with people on a remarkable one-to-one basis. We talk about this a lot in radio, don't we, about communication and engagement with the audience. Well, I think in a way he was the audience, even though he wasn't from Nottingham. He'd come up to the city as a youth, but he felt part of his adopted town and he felt part of the community. And he was the community on air, helping individuals within it to talk to one another.
Radio Nottingham News with Louise Burt. Thousands of mourners are gathering in Nottingham to pay their last respects to the BBC broadcaster Dennis McCarthy. His funeral takes place today at St Barnabas Cathedral on Derby Road, and the police are closing roads in the city to allow the horse-drawn hearse to make its way there.
By placing this BBC microphone alongside the coffin, we pay tribute to the professionalism, integrity, and human warmth that Dennis brought to his work in radio, in television, and in particular to BBC local radio. And we honour the skill and talent which were the hallmark of his work among us.
After he died, I naturally obviously went down to Buggins Cottage, was where he lived, and I remember we were standing where he had this outside cinema. He had a cinema detached from there, with proper cinema seats and everything, because he loved the cinema. Standing by the cinema outside, and Marjorie came out, his wife, and she had curlers in. And I remember the curlers because when I hugged her, I remember them sticking in my face. And she said, you know, John, he was a bugger to live with, but he's a bugger to live without.
Our listeners know us. We really are in the living room with them, because we don't talk over them, under them or anything. We don't talk at them. We're talking with them and we're working with them. I think we're nearer to our audience, we're nearer to our listeners than anyone else. We're ever so near to them, ever so near. That's it.
The Dennis McCarthy Story was a Radio Moments production by David Lloyd, with thanks to Owen McCarthy and Kevin Brewer for audio material and production support.